Welcome to Base by Base, the paper cast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to follow and rate us in your podcast app. Imagine you have a highly advanced targeted weapon designed to exploit a specific flaw in a cancer cell's armor.
Right, like a therapy that is tailor-made for a tumor's exact genetic profile.
Exactly. The clinical data tells you it should be a total slam dunk, you know? For half the patients, it works perfectly. The cancer cells simply cannot withstand the attack and they die. But for the other half of the patients, the cancer mysteriously survives.
I mean, it is arguably one of the most frustrating phenomena in oncology today. The drug binds to the intended target, and the genomic profile of the tumor dictates that the cell should undergo apoptosis.
Yeah, by all accounts, it should be a lethal hit.
Right. Yet the clinical outcome diverges entirely from the molecular theory. The cells just keep dividing.
It really prompts you to wonder what really happens when a cancer cell takes a vital piece of its own replication machinery and, well, breaks it just enough to survive a deadly drug.
And more importantly, how could this change the way we predict which patients will actually respond to targeted therapy?
It's almost like the cancer cells are on a sinking ship.
Yeah.
You plug the main hole, and by all laws of physics, they should sink. But somehow these cells are building a completely new buoyancy system on the fly.
Today we celebrate the work of Kairi Pappas, Charles L. Sawyers, and the research team at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, who have advanced our understanding of PRP inhibitor resistance in prostate cancer.
And just to give you some timeline context for this deep dive, this research was published in the journal PNAS on June 3, 2025.
It's a really incredible piece of work.
It is. But to understand why the MSKCC team needed to investigate this in the first place, we really have to look at the clinical reality of metastatic castration-resistant prostate cancer, or mCRPC.
The landscape for mCRPC has shifted significantly over the last decade. Historically, once a tumor bypassed androgen deprivation therapy, the options were severely limited.
Right, you were kind of out of a roadmap at that point.
Exactly. But the introduction of PRP inhibitors, like olaparib, changed that trajectory entirely. This is specifically a breakthrough for tumors harboring BRCA1 or BRCA2 mutations.
Now, most of the time, when you hear BRCA mutations, your mind immediately goes to breast and ovarian cancer, and typically as a germline mutation that someone inherited from a parent.
Yes, that's the classic association most people have.
But in the context of prostate cancer, the genomic profile is distinctly different, right? BRCA2 mutations heavily outnumber BRCA1, and more importantly, roughly half of these BRCA mutations are somatic.
Which means the patient wasn't born with the defect. The tumor actually acquired it spontaneously during its evolution.
Right.
And because these mutations completely abrogate homologous recombination, the cell loses its primary mechanism for error-free repair of DNA double-strand breaks.
So it's incredibly vulnerable.
Very. PRP inhibitors are engineered to exploit that very specific synthetic lethality. You knock out the backup repair pathway with the drug, and a BRCA-deficient cell basically has no way to fix its DNA.
But let's pause on the clinical reality for a second, because this is the entire reason this study exists. About 50% of these BRCA mutant prostate cancer patients exhibit upfront resistance to PRP inhibitors.
Half of the patients, I mean, they have the precise biomarker the drug is built for, yet they derive zero clinical benefit from day one.
Wow.
Yeah, the tumor just shrugs off the therapy as if the homologous recombination deficiency wasn't even there.
Okay, let's unpack this. If PRP inhibitors work by trapping the PRP1 protein directly on the DNA strand to cause a fatal traffic jam for the cellular replication machinery, how are these BRCA deficient cells surviving the crash?
That is the big question.
Because they are already completely compromised in their DNA repair pathways. A replication fork colliding with a trapped PRP1 complex should be a catastrophic terminal event for that cell.
And that collision is usually lethal.
Mm.
When the replicasome hits that trapped PRP1 protein, the replication fork stalls out. Without BRCA-mediated repair to stabilize and restart that fork, it collapses into a highly toxic double-strand break. If a BRCA-deficient tumor is surviving that onslaught, it implies a fundamental rewiring of how the cell manages replication stress.
Like, before the fork ever has a chance to collapse in the first place.
Exactly. It's managing the stress upstream.
So, to untangle that rewiring, the researchers needed a robust model. But you can't just pull standard human mCRPC cell lines off the shelf for this, can you?
No, you really can't. Previous attempts using engineered human cell lines like LNTP, they only yielded modest sensitivity to PRP inhibitors.
Which doesn't really help.
Right, because it doesn't accurately reflect the profound synthetic lethality we observe in actual human patients. The standard flat dish cell lines lack the complex stromal interactions and the specific genetic background required to truly model this disease.
So the team pivoted to primary mouse prostate organoids. And these 3D cultures maintain the crucial epithelial architecture, which is so important.
They do. They took these wild-type organoids and used CRISPR to introduce a biallelic loss of Brachy2. But they didn't stop there. They also did targeted knockouts of TRPV53, 10, and RB1.
They didn't just knock out the primary target, they layered in the loss of major tumor suppressors to mirror the aggressive, heterogeneous genetic landscape you actually see in a patient's tumor.
Yeah, that multi-hit genetic background was the key. By establishing that specific environment, the organoids suddenly exhibited the exquisite sensitivity seen in the clinic.
We are talking about the IC50. That's the concentration required to inhibit growth by 50% plummeting, right?
Oh, absolutely plummeting.
Yeah.
It dropped from the 10 micromolar range all the way down to between 10 and 333 nanomolar.
Wow.
The cells became up to 1,000 times more sensitive to olaparib.
Wait, so instead of trying to find the resistance in human cells, they deliberately engineered mouse cells to be incredibly fragile, just so they could hit them with a massive genetic hammer and see what survived.
I know it sounds wild, but the logic of the experimental design demands that fragility. Yeah, if you want to run a genome-wide CRISPR screen to uncover resistance mechanisms, your baseline model has to be overwhelmingly susceptible to the drug. You need the signal-to-noise ratio to be perfect.
Oh, I see. That makes a lot of sense. So they utilized the Bree lentiviral library, which contains over 78,000 guide RNAs, to systematically knock out genes across millions of these hypersensitive organoid cells.
Exactly. And then they flood the system with a lethal 100 nanomolar dose of olaparib and just wait for 21 days, which is roughly 10 cell division cycles.
And given how fragile they made this model, the vast majority of those cells undergo apoptosis and die.
They do. So the ones that remain alive after 3 weeks, they hold the answer.
Right.
The genetic knockout they received from the lentiviral library must be the mechanical driver of their survival.
So when the team sequenced the DNA of the surviving organoids to identify the enriched guide RNAs, the data clustered heavily around three specific genes: CDT1, CDC6, and DBF4.
Right. And those three are core components of the DNA pre-replication complex, or pre-RC.
Now, for those who might need a quick refresher, what exactly is the pre-RC doing normally?
Well, before a cell can enter S phase and divide, it has to license its replication origins.
Like giving permission to start copying.
Exactly. The pre-RC physically loads the MCM helicase onto the DNA, effectively marking the exact spots where DNA unwinding and replication will begin. It ensures the genome is copied exactly once per cell cycle.
Here's where it gets really interesting. It's like the pre-RC is the starter pistol for a race. If the pistol misfires, the runners go slower. But somehow, that slower pace prevents them from tripping over the hurdles left by the PRP inhibitor.
That is a great analogy. That altered dynamic is what saves the cell. When you deplete CDT1 or CDC6, you restrict the number of licensed origins.
So there's fewer starting lines.
Right. The cell fires fewer replication forks, and the overall speed of DNA synthesis drops.
But dropping the speed of replication doesn't remove the trapped PRP1 proteins from the DNA. The hurdles are still on the track. Why does slowing down prevent the fatal crash?
It comes down to replication fork stability and nucleotide pool management.
Okay.
When a cell with normal origin licensing gets hit with a PRP inhibitor, thousands of replication forks stall simultaneously at those trapped proteins.
So it's a massive system-wide traffic jam.
Exactly. The cell panics and fires dormant origins to try and rescue the replication process. But this massive uncoordinated firing exhausts the cellular pool of nucleotides and completely depletes replication factors like RPA.
The cell essentially starves its own repair machinery by trying to fix everything at once, causing the forks to collapse into double-strand breaks.
Right. By crippling the pre-RC, the cancer cell prevents that systemic panic. With fewer origins firing, the nucleotide pools aren't exhausted. So when a fork stalls at a trapped PRP1 protein, it has the time and the biochemical resources to engage alternative tolerance mechanisms, things like fork reversal or translesion synthesis,
which allows it to bypass the lesion without the fork collapsing. And the researchers proved this chemically, didn't they? They looked at gamma H2AX foci, which are the classic cellular markers for double-strand DNA breaks.
They did. In the highly sensitive organoids, adding olaparib caused a massive sustained spike in those damage markers. I mean, the genomes were shattering.
Wow.
But in the organoids with the CDT1 or CDC6 knockouts, those gamma H2AX foci appeared briefly and then resolved within 4 hours. The cells were managing the PREP-induced damage on the fly.
That's incredible. And they actually map this physically using DNA fiber assays. If you feed the cells fluorescent thymidine analogs like CLDU and IDU, you can track the actual progression of individual replication forks under a microscope.
Yeah, the fiber assays confirm the mechanism visually. It's really striking data.
What did it look like?
Well, in a typical BRCA2 deficient cell exposed to a PRP inhibitor, the nascent DNA strands at stalled forks are actively degraded by nucleases. You can literally see the fluorescent tracks getting chewed away.
But when the PRC is impaired,
those tracks remain completely intact. The slower origin licensing miraculously shields the replication fork from nucleolytic degradation.
Hold on. If we look at something like the cancer dependency map, you know, DepMap genes like CDT1 are classified as core essential. If you knock out a core component of the pre-replication complex in a standard cancer cell line, it undergoes cell cycle arrest and dies. How is this tumor surviving, let alone forming a resistance shield without a functional pre-RC?
It is a phenomenal display of context-dependent tumor biology. In a healthy cell, or even many standard cancer lines, severe pre-RC impairment is lethal.
Yeah.
But the specific genomic chaos of MCRPC, particularly the concurrent loss of RB1 and TRP53, allows these cells to tolerate a drastic reduction in origin licensing.
So the other mutations cover for it.
Exactly. Yeah. And to prove this wasn't just an in vitro artifact, the team injected these CDT1 depleted organoids into mice.
You'd assume they wouldn't engraft well, given how vital that gene normally is.
You would think so, but they formed robust subcutaneous tumors. They grew slightly slower than the parental lines, taking a minor hit to their proliferative capacity.
Right.
But they completely retained the CDT1 deletion and their profound resistance to olaparib.
We need to bridge this back to the human patient, because a mouse model is only as good as its clinical translation. Does this highly specific pre-RC loss actually happen in real people?
The clinical data integration in this paper is arguably its most sobering aspect. When the team analyzed large-scale genomic datasets from patients with castration-resistant prostate cancer, they found that roughly 50% of these tumors harbor a copy number loss of these pre-RC complex genes.
Let that sit for a moment. Half of the patients walking into the clinic already possess this underlying genetic alteration.
Yeah. For CDT1 specifically, the copy number loss is present in up to 65% of cases. And crucially, these pre-RC losses significantly co-occur with BRCA2 mutations.
So this isn't some rare acquired resistance mechanism that develops after months of treatment. This is a massive pre-existing shield. The tumors already have this slow replication architecture in place before the PIHE inhibitor even enters the patient's bloodstream. That perfectly explains the 50% upfront failure rate we talked about earlier.
The tumor has proactively engineered its escape route. But because the researchers mapped the exact biochemical pathways of that escape route, they uncovered a vulnerability to exploit.
Right. If the cancer is hiding behind a broken starter pistol, how do we force the race to happen? How do we strip away that shield?
We target the regulatory network governing the pre-RC, specifically a protein called geminin.
Okay, in a normal cell cycle, geminin acts as the strict negative regulator of CDT1. During the S and G2 phases, geminin physically binds to CDT1 and sequesters it.
It locks CDT1 away to ensure that once a replication origin has fired, it cannot be licensed again. Re-replicating the same segment of DNA is catastrophic for genomic stability.
Right.
So geminin is basically the master brake on the origin licensing system.
So the cancer survives the first drug by slowing down its replication engine. We counterattack by cutting the brakes, meaning geminin forcing the engine to rev out of control until it blows up.
Biologically, that is exactly what happens. The team took the resistant organoids, the ones surviving PARP inhibition due to CDC6 depletion, and used CRISPR to knock down geminin.
And by removing that brake, you unleash whatever residual CDT1 is left in the cell.
Yes. That forces origin licensing to occur at entirely inappropriate times during the cell cycle.
Wow.
It completely reversed the resistance. And they didn't just test this with olaparib. They validated it using AZD5305.
Oh, that's the highly selective next-generation PRP1 inhibitor currently advancing through phase 3 clinical trials, right?
Exactly. AZD5305 is designed to have much lower hematological toxicity than older drugs because it selectively traps PARP1 without affecting PARP2.
So when you remove geminin, the cell's baseline replication stress skyrockets. the origins fire chaotically.
And when you introduce the PARP inhibitor on top of that drug-induced chaos, the cancer cell is pushed far beyond its tolerance threshold. It attempts to segregate a massively fragmented, under-replicated genome during mitosis.
Which means the cell undergoes what we call mitotic catastrophe and self-destructs.
Precisely.
Using CRISPR to validate the pathway is elegant, but translating that to a human patient requires pharmacology. We need a small molecule that can perform that same break-cutting maneuver.
And the researchers actually utilized a pharmacologic inhibitor called AF615. This compound is specifically designed to disrupt the protein-protein interaction between CDT1 and Geminin.
So it chemically frees CDT1 from sequestration.
It does. Treating the highly resistant organoids with AF615 in combination with new PARP inhibitor AZD5305 fully restored drug sensitivity.
That's huge.
Yeah, even at vanishingly small doses, just 1 nanomolar of AZD5305, the addition of the Geminin inhibitor eradicated the resistant cells.
The therapeutic logic is incredibly compelling. You screen a patient, identify the BRCA2 mutation and the pre-RC loss, and instead of giving them a PRP inhibitor that you know will fail, you hit them with the PRP inhibitor plus AF615 to forcibly revoke the resistance mechanism.
It is a brilliant blueprint for rational combination therapy. However, the translational hurdles between this foundational biology and the standard of care are, well, they're substantial.
Always are. What's the biggest roadblock?
First, we need extensive longitudinal data from larger patient cohorts to definitively validate pre-RC copy number status as a predictive clinical biomarker for PRP inhibitor failure.
Right. You'd need to retrospectively and prospectively track thousands of patients to prove that this CDT1 or CDC6 loss tightly correlates with progression-free survival over years of treatment.
Furthermore, we face a major infrastructural challenge in genomic medicine. Genes like CDT1, CDC6, and DBF4 are not routinely included in standard commercial next-generation sequencing panels for oncology.
Wait, really? So if a patient's tumor is sequenced today at a major hospital, the oncologist won't even see the pre-RC copy number loss because the panel simply isn't designed to look for it.
Exactly. We can't act on a biomarker if our diagnostic tools are blind to it.
Yeah, that makes sense.
The sequencing panels will have to evolve to incorporate these resistance genes before this combination therapy can be deployed effectively.
The team also emphasized the need to determine if this mechanism is exclusive to the BRCA2 deficient environment, or if tumors driven by BRCA1 mutations utilize the same pre-RC alteration to survive replication stress.
Right, because the biology of BRCA1 and BRCA2, while related, have distinct functional nuances in how they manage stalled forks.
There is clearly more to uncover, but the central insight from this research fundamentally reframes our approach. Loss of pre-replication complex genes like CDT1 acts as an upfront shield against PRP inhibitors in BRCA2 mutant prostate cancer. By targeting the regulators of this complex, we might be able to strip away that shield and force the cancer to succumb to therapy.
It emphasizes that resistance isn't always about the tumor actively mutating the drug's target. Sometimes it's about the tumor passively altering its own cellular pacing to render the drug's mechanism of action irrelevant. By understanding that pacing, we can design therapies that force the cell into fatal metabolic errors.
What does this mean for the future of personalized oncology? And could this resistance mechanism extend beyond prostate cancer to other therapies that induce replication stress?
It's a question that could shape the next decade of cancer research.
This episode was based on an open access article under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this, follow or subscribe in your podcast app and leave a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support our work, use the donation link in the description. Now stay with us for an original track created especially for this episode and inspired by the article you've just heard about. Thanks for listening, and join us next time as we explore more science base by base. Lights up like a flare. BRCA2's gone, mistakes are bad. Olaparib in the air. But the cells don't read the script, they find a quiet way. Slow the start, loosen the grip, and watch the crash.
CDT, one fall, CDC, six fades, DBF4 slips out of frame.